You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Hello everyone, I'm Charlotte Aldrett. I am Director of Public Services and Communities here at the RSA. I'm delighted to introduce today's event. I'm here to launch the final report of the RSA's Inclusive Growth Commission. As Director of the Commission, it's been a personal labour of love for me over the last 12 months. This time last year, we were gearing up for the start of the Commission, set up to identify practical ways to enable as many people as possible to both contribute to and benefit from a new kind of inclusive economic growth. Brexit then brought our agenda to the political fore, since we've had a new government, a new approach to industrial strategies, and Donald Trump. Next week, we look to the Netherlands, and in 6 weeks, to the French presidential elections. Countries across the world are asking, how can we make the economy work for everyone? What politics can get us there? And we are seeking to find how can we improve our social and economic policy making to ensure we build a fairer, more productive, more inclusive economy. It's the budget tomorrow. Ahead of that, and following a fantastic day with the Commission and partners in Bradford yesterday, we're today setting out our final recommendations. So I'm delighted to welcome Commission Chair Stephanie Flanders. Stephanie is Chief Market Strategist for the UK and Europe at JP Morgan and was formerly Economics Editor at the BBC. We'll hear more from Stephanie on the Commission's work over the last year, including our recommendations and five key principles for inclusive growth. We're also pleased to welcome three distinguished panellists to respond to the Commission's recommendations and bring further insight into the economic and public policy priorities, specific place-based strategies and the impact of Brexit. Joining the panel, therefore, is Irene Lucas, Chief Executive of Sunderland City Council, Tim Besley, Professor of Economics and Science at the LSE, and Sir Richard Leese, Leader of Manchester City Council. Stephanie.
Thank you very much. I was thinking back to when we launched this commission just under a year ago here, and what my goals were at that time. Of course, it's all about me. You know, I think we were hoping to continue the amazing work that the City Growth Commission had done. Charlotte was obviously very closely involved with that and many of the others here today. And to sort of paint a picture of what the next generation of this agenda of devolution might look like. I think as part of that, we wanted to be feeding into conversations, campaigns, plans around upcoming mayoral elections this year, and with any luck also things more Westminster related like the coming budget and not tomorrow's budget but the one that we're supposed to pay more attention to, which is in the autumn, and the next spending review, if we still have spending reviews in the next few years. But I think, you know, the sort of less modest piece of it, which Charlotte's already mentioned, was we felt really was a crucial subject to get into, was to contribute something quite particular to this broader debate about capitalism and how it's not working for too many people and the political forces that that's unleashed. And of course, we didn't know, although of course we might have suspected, that our deliberations were going to be in the shadow of the Brexit vote, kind of literally so in the case of our first evidence session in Sheffield, which was held, I think, 5 days after Sheffield had voted overwhelmingly in favour of leaving the EU. I had a sort of personal thing that I wanted to be practical but not feeble. You know, practical, if you really say something that feels like it could really happen, then the argument is always, well, it's feeble, we could do that any time. Can't you be more imaginative? And then you come up with something imaginative and people say, well, that's hopelessly utopian. You're never going to be able to put that into place. So we were trying to find somewhere in between. Personally, what have I learnt from this process, trying to achieve those things? Well, I think, you know, one lesson I had was that money was an important part of this, but not the only thing. And the more we looked at it, the more it often felt like it was not. I mean, austerity had made a big impact on local leaders and indeed Westminster officials' ability to pursue this inclusive growth agenda. But it wasn't only in terms of reducing the quantity of money. It was actually about changing the composition of money, forcing people and policymakers to put money more and more into short-term reactive spending and less in preventative spending. And there's a very interesting study that Greater Manchester, the New Economy, have done showing how the composition of spending in the Greater Manchester area has changed over time. That is a picture that is true across the country. And in this environment of austerity, it seemed even more crazy to be tying people's hands and putting money in separate pots and saying, no, you can't combine the two and actually try and see the big picture. The other lesson I had was that it wasn't actually about a sort of traditional devolution agenda, or it certainly wasn't devolution for its own sake. And that actually, the light bulb moment I had was my first meeting with you, Richard, where you were talking to me about how you saw the relationship with providers and with central government, with Department of Health, as you've worked through the health and social care combination, that really this was talking about a new relationship in which you were empowering local government to make trade-offs and be more long-term, but not just kind of handing them the keys and saying, you know, tell us when you're done. And I thought that model, that kind of joint commissioning model, we realised could really be applied to a lot of other areas, we think particularly in the skills and training area, which the government's so focused on. So I particularly, we're grateful to many contributions that Greater Manchester has done, but that for me has been particularly important. And I think finally for me, just on a personal level, this quality of growth debate really chimes with people. And of course, it chimed even more in the context of Brexit. And I think that the piece of that which is saying, look, you've got, if you're going to get into the sort of under the skin of how growth feels to people, you need to think about spending in a place-based approach, not just different pots of money. You know, all of those issues, the fact that we can't just talk about growth in this very narrow economic way anymore, I think that was certainly, it was striking to me how much people said, oh yeah, no, that sounds brilliant, I completely agree with that. And we saw in all of our evidence sessions people trying to do that in different ways, whether it was Plymouth, whether it was Nottingham, Barking and Dagenham. We had lots of different experiences in also the events we had in Edinburgh and in Birmingham and other parts of the country, Cardiff. Talking to the mayor of Bristol, you know, is another person who's really trying to get to grips with this. So what are the principles that we kind of came up with? And the proposals themselves. Well, I'm going to be very brief here because you've got the report in front of you and you can see what they are. But, you know, building on my lessons, one of them, actually the second principle, is that we do need to measure the human experience of growth, and that that has partly a subjective dimension. As an economist, I always get nervous when people start getting too airy-fairy, these kind of subjective ideas. I'm not utterly sure we're capturing it with the happiness measures and all of those things. But there is inevitably a qualitative piece to this. But I think there's also a hard data piece that we just don't have. The human-related bits of growth, you know, not just GDP, but and not just jobs created, but what kind of wage growth are those jobs bringing? How is that growth overall delivered in terms of household poverty levels in that area? The local level data we have is just terrible, and that was one of the things that for me personally I found kind of offensive about the current situation, and we're making a wholehearted plea for that. A binding mission was the first principle, that you really do need to decide what you're trying to do and go push through it. We saw that in lots of different places in some of our case studies. Understand the whole system, which inevitably means also freeing policymakers to understand the whole system. You can't have this broader approach to growth if the policies themselves are all very narrow. The fourth principle was invest at scale. And I think crucial piece of that scale is not just in any given year, but to have the long-term flexibility to make investment choices, something that's really lacking in a lot of the city deals and the growth fund and other things we've seen already. And entrepreneurial whole place leadership is that fifth principle, which we see in lots of different places. But I think the key thing of that is it's not just the people who are sort of nominally in charge of things. It's bringing in, you've often had sort of magical things happen because you brought in a lot of other people around the table. And the proposals, again, I think feed on all of these the principles and the experiences, the very positive experience that we've had that are all in there. Accompanying document that we released yesterday. There's great stories of from around the world, but around the UK particularly, demonstrating these principles. We think there should be new social contracts between Whitehall and the combined authorities to give them greater responsibility for and control over the spending in their area. And that's the kind of more along the joint commissioning model that we talked about before. I think it could involve a lot of money, potentially, but I do think it's important we see this as a new relationship, a reset of the relationship between town halls and Whitehall, rather than just a straightforward handing over of power. But I think a really important piece of that, which Treasury is interested in, is the place-based spending reviews as a culmination of that, which would also allow multi-year planning with any luck. The independent UK Inclusive Growth Investment Fund, we think, could make manifest the government's commitment to a country that works for everyone, not the privileged few, as Theresa May says. Realistically, if we think about repatriated funds from the European Structural and Investment Funds, if we also combine the existing growth fund, we are talking about over 20 years, £76 billion, but that is only, you know, £3 or £4 billion a year for that. That statistical piece, we want a quarterly measure of inclusive growth from the ONS that I think could still have, would be involved, it would be hard data. It would be things like I mentioned before about poverty impact and median wages rather than an entirely subjective measure. But at least it would give us a broader sense of the consequences of growth, not just the GDP. Crucially, we think as part of this, and we argued very strongly in the interim report, you can't do any of this without thinking of social and economic policies as two sides of the same coin. You know, this is about when you talk about joining up policies and keeping them out of not having separate pots of money with too many strings attached, and you're making this inclusive growth choices, bringing economic and social policy together is really crucial. The difficulty of doing that was brought home to me when we were in Edinburgh, when it was pointed out that one of the problems they have in trying to combine their inclusive growth, the administration has inclusive growth agenda, is that all of the traditionally all of the economists have been based in Glasgow and the social policy people have been based in Edinburgh and they never even had coffee together. So it was quite hard for them to combine. But they're working very hard on poverty-proofing policy proposals, and that's kind of an interesting area for us. And finally, you see that the proposal, which is to have creation of new tools and institutions, we're not going to spell them out because that's part of the beauty of some of these things, to help deliver place-based industrial strategies. Because we think this cannot only be a policy that fits big cities like Greater Manchester. We think we could still also, you want to capture the spirit of this, the broader approach to growth, the place-based approach in everything you do, and particularly in the industrial policy that the government's admits it has still quite a lot of work to do. So that's it. I'm not going to say any more. Hard to summarise a year's work in one minute or even 10 minutes. But I am grateful for the RSA and for all of the funders of the report and giving me this opportunity. I might say a little bit after the discussion, but thanks very much for now.
Thank you, Stephanie. So first to hear from Irene Lucas.
Hey, afternoon, everybody. In addition to coming from Sunderland, as you can probably tell from the accent, I'm also representing Quay Cities and will bring a bit of a view from Quay Cities. I'm going to talk really briefly about three things: where the growth will happen, why it needs to happen, and how we collectively can make it happen. So first of all, in terms of where it will happen, I agree with Stephanie around the devolution argument. But for me, it's really important in considering inclusive growth and developing solutions to it that we understand where the growth in the UK will come from. Key cities, 26 key cities in the UK, currently make up 11% of the UK economy. And in terms of GVA, our key cities are growing at a faster rate than our larger cities, mainly because of the land, availability of land, and the availability of opportunities to diversify. almost half of our key cities are performing above the national average. If you look at Sunderland specifically and where that's going in relation to the industrial strategy, in Sunderland, 17% of our jobs are in manufacturing compared with 11% nationally. And this continues to increase. For example, in 2009, it was only 14%, and many more jobs are being created currently. As you're probably aware, Sunderland exported by far the largest amounts of goods and services of any city in the UK, and the value of Sunderland's exports was £4.85 billion, equating to about £40,500 per job. But I think that any national inclusive growth strategy that ignores the growth of all places across the country is flawed. I think it's really essential that we celebrate the strength of our core cities and the growth poles that they have become. But we also recognise, particularly in developing an industrial strategy and an advanced manufacturing strategy, that all places in this country have a role to play. I think the reason why inclusive growth is important is post-referendum, we've heard much about the places which have been left behind. And in fact, of the 26 key cities, the reality is that 21 of them actually voted to leave. So it's really important that our national policy looks not just to major cities, but all places. So even before the challenges in relation to the impacts of the UK's departure from the EU, even those places flourishing had a polarised situation with those people who would benefit directly from economic growth and those people who were very definitely in communities that would feel that they were left behind. And whilst the national government currently wrestles with the process of exiting from the EU, I think it's really important that we start right now with this piece of work, right now, to look at the ways in which for example, the £2.5 billion, which is tied up in the European Social Investment Fund, will disappear. And what we do now to start to have a dialogue to look at how we might tackle it. I think the real success of this work, though, will only materialise if the findings and evidence that are in this document are taken forward in real practical ways in which we deliver the challenges and some of the proposals that are coming out, particularly on page 40 and 42. Other examples that I would like to cite are in the how of what we do with this, are practical examples around our key cities working together around thematic agglomeration. So, for example, the way that Coventry and Sunderland are working together collaboratively around the automotive sector would be one such example. I think another practical example, if we take the point that there is no new money, is to make sure that we use all the levers we can in the money that is available. So any grant funding, any regeneration funding, any infrastructure funding. I believe, and I've said this on page 30, that we should use the levers that we have, the money which already exists within our system, to make sure that that's driving social inclusion across all of our places, such as a Section 106 agreement, which currently exists, which is generally used for social goods, such as perhaps requiring a big infrastructure project to create 45 apprentices. There is absolutely no reason why we couldn't have an expansion of a 106 agreement, which would include such things as, for example, how many looked after children, how many not in education, employment and training, what wider benefits to those communities would exist. And in closing, all I'd like to say is I really think if ever there was a time for the leaders in this country to step up to the plate, Whitehall, Town Hall and private sector, and make this happen, then that time is now.
Our So I'd like to say a few words in sort of three capacities. As an academic economist, as a member of a commission that recently reported with similar ambitions, and finally as a member of the government's National Infrastructure Commission, all of which overlap with the content of this report. Now, first of all, I would like to congratulate the commission on what is a really interesting contribution to the debate. And in particular, I'd like to congratulate them on writing such a short report. I really do think, and this is something which I've tried to honour, but more in the breach, unfortunately, with some of the work I've been involved in, that this is much more likely to be read and be debated because of that. And you can have as much supporting analysis as you like behind it, but it is important to convey the message succinctly and to have a clear and concise narrative, and I think you've really achieved that. The second thing I'd like to say is this is more as a member of various commissions, indeed one at RSA over the years. I think reports like this, you have to realise, will probably, if they're going to be influential, have a somewhat slow burn. It's, of course, tempting to pursue as much publicity as you can on the first few days when you launch the report, but actually a lot of the hard work is done in the subsequent period where you want to get those ideas out there, you want to continue to have them debated, and long after anybody might have stopped putting this thing in either social media or the newspapers, you have to keep going. And in fact, it was a good example from our first LSE Growth Commission. It was a full 18 months after we launched the commission report that George Osborne announced the National Infrastructure Commission, which had been one of our key proposals. So you really just do need to keep going and trying to persuade people. If you believe in your ideas, keep pushing them. But one point that Stephanie made, and I just want to underline, is and I think this is a big issue for anyone who either wants to do research or policy analysis in the UK, is the appalling level of UK regional data. And you might think, well, this is just the kind of comment that somebody who does research would make. But actually, it's much more important than that, because so much policy now is influenced by evidence. And the difficulty of getting up-to-date and accurate data on important things, and the way that contributes to policy, it's really very important that we up our game in the UK on that. And we are far, far behind. And of course, many of you will not have experience working with other countries' data, but we are far, far behind other countries. And that means having the kind of coherent debate we want to have around the place-based policy issues is much more difficult. I want to say a couple of words around the kind of institutional framework. So the way the academic economic debate has gone on growth, and this is a caricature, but I think it serves to make the point I want to make, that essentially the view now is getting the institutional framework right is 90-some percent of what's important in generating growth and inclusive growth. Now, what do I mean by that? What I mean is making sure the decision-making structures, the way they use evidence, are in place to deliver. And I think, again, we are a very, very long way away in the UK from having a coherent set of structures that are needed to support place-based policy. This came home to me particularly in a report that some of you may have seen that we wrote in the National Infrastructure Commission on the Oxford, Milton Keynes, Cambridge corridor. And that obviously involves multiple LEPs, multiple county councils, multiple, in some cases, city councils, trying to build inside that structure anything which looks moderately coherent, not to mention the fact we've got to work across about five different government departments, is a truly bewildering and daunting task. And we are just so far away in the UK from being able to create what I would regard as economically relevant institutional structures. You talk about whole place leadership, and of course that's needed. But what is the whole place? And when it comes to economic development, it will be different for different items. So, for example, for infrastructure, creating road networks and rail, what is a whole place is probably rather different than what it is for creating other. And we've got, a long way to go. And I think you have some very interesting things to say on that, but I want to flag that up as what I view as one of the principal challenges that we also face. Finally, something you didn't talk about very much, and you must have had your reasons, but I'll just finish on that, is the intergenerational challenges of inclusivity. Maybe you just thought that was too daunting a task to take up. But whether it's around housing, which is, of course, vitally a place-based policy, whether it's about the environment and the kind of legacy we're going to be leaving to our children and grandchildren in terms of the spaces and unbreathable air and rising global temperatures. These are absolutely of the essence. If anyone is thinking about inclusivity, we shouldn't only be thinking about those who are here now, but inclusive of the interests of those who are yet to come. And, of course, you can only do so much in a report, but I think we shouldn't be defining inclusivity so narrowly as to forget the interests of future generations. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. And as well as being leader of Manchester City Council, I think I'm also representing Core Cities UK and the LGA City Regions Board here this afternoon. And again, can I add my congratulations to Stephanie, Charlotte and the Commission for a report which I think is an important contribution to policy. I think it's timely, particularly in the light of things that have happened since they began work on the report, both Brexit and an industrial policy coming out of government for the first time for a long time, and for a report, and a report which I think is, at least for some people, very challenging. It challenges us to look at conventional ways of judging the economy, ways that are largely driven by GVA, productivity measured by GVA per head, but ways that largely leave people out of the equation, and to start looking at different ways of measuring the economy, to start developing notions of good growth and of growth where everybody benefits rather than just some people benefit. It also challenges particularly government around austerity, because clearly austerity is not working. It's not working for all of those people that are being left behind, and instead asks us to look at a model that still means that we live within our means, because we have to do that, but that we live in our means by investing in people rather than cutting people off. And by investing people, we increase the extent to which they become assets to themselves and to the economy rather than liabilities. There are perhaps three key points for me in the way we do that, and this is repeating inevitably points that have already been made. First of all, it challenges to end the false dichotomy between social and economic policy. When I read that in the examples, it reminds me of work that was done for Greater Manchester, the Manchester Independent Economic Review, published in 2009, where a bunch of economists, largely from the London School of Economics, their number one recommendation to improve our economy in the long term was to invest in early years, to invest in under fives, exactly the sort of investment in social infrastructure that the Commission have talked about in the report. It talks about the case for place-based integration, and I'll think of what we're trying to do with health and social care in Greater Manchester at the moment, a mixture of devolution, decentralisation and of integration. It only works because we are operating at the right spatial level for that to work. But it's not simply about delivering better health and social care services in their own right. It is looking about all of those things that have an impact on health. And one of the biggest things that has an impact on health is work. It immediately starts building the linkages between important major areas of social policy and economic well-being. Similarly, the Working Well programme, the only bit of the work programme that has been commissioned locally, allows us to join up a whole range of social programmes to support an objective of getting people back into work, of being assets rather than of being liabilities. It also challenges how we do that spatially. And it's absolutely the case that individual local authorities, by and large, can't do that. We have to come together, we have to work together to create the scale and the capacity. And yes, that can be a different scale for different things. So in the north of England, we see combined authorities dealing with issues like skills, issues like employment programmes. But for major transport, we are operating on a pan-northern basis. But in each case, we locally have created that capacity. Irene said we had to step up to the plate. Yes, yes, we do. Devolution is not a gift. It doesn't come automatically. It does entail new partnership working between central and local government. That's a challenge for both. But it's also a challenge for local government to recognise we simply cannot go on as we are and that we have to change ourselves. And we have to particularly grasp a leadership responsibility that goes way beyond our statutory responsibilities. We have to take a responsibility for the whole of place. These are challenges that so far have been partially met, but only in some places. And I think we should be able to use the Commission's report again over the long term to bring the changes we need. Certainly in Greater Manchester, where we're currently refreshing the Greater Manchester strategy, our economic strategy, we will be using this to make sure that we do have a more inclusive approach to the economy in Greater Manchester. It's a challenge for government that if it is serious about what it says about a more inclusive Britain, this lays out the tools that they need to use in order to create that. And finally, it is, yet again, a challenge for local government, our willingness to take responsibility for the people and places we represent. This will help us enormously as long as we have the courage to accept what's wrong and what we can do about it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to Stephanie and our panellists. I think the contributions that we've heard really speak to the breadth that of issues that come under inclusive growth. On the one hand, you've got some kind of very hard economic issues around increasing our productivity, actually achieving growth, let alone inclusive growth. And you've got issues of kind of identity, belonging, the erosion of community on the other, and the types of issues that Irene was mentioning with regard to the Leave vote. So the Inclusive Growth Commission has covered a huge range. Before I turn to questions from the audience, just a couple of questions from me, really. The first, I think, speaks to the fact that this is not just about, as we've said, kind of how you do policy or how government does stuff in general. This really does speak to how business itself can play a part in creating a more inclusive economy. And I think there's something about the terms of trade that we want to establish with business and industry. You know, if they want to do business in our place, in our country, how can we speak to the kind of a new bar that we want to set, but be that around zero-hour contracts, be around national living wage, or other aspects that go into creating quality jobs. So my question to the panel is around the role of business. How can we encourage business to play ball on this and recognise it's in their interest, arguably? Secondly, is around global finance again. So how do we speak to the fact that globalisation as a concept, as a process, is under threat with increasing protectionism? How does that global dimension feed into the work that we're doing and the work that nation states and cities are trying to do? And then a bit close to home, tomorrow we've got the budget. And what would you like to see from the Chancellor, potentially, if not tomorrow, come that autumn statement later in the year? So I'm going to start with Irene and work this way.
Okay, I'd like to take the point about the involvement of the private sector. And I think that one way of encouraging the private sector to work in partnership with central government and local government is by seeing just how important inclusive growth is to us. At the minute, it's very benign. We know in policy venues such as this, where policy is discussed and debated, we talk about inclusive growth. I'm not terribly sure that if we were to be in a room full of the private sector, that they would all get it. So the first thing for me is to make sure that nationally we're saying this is important to us. If you are going to be working in our communities, it's vitally important to us that you give back to those communities in some measurable way. I really do think that issue of measurement is important, and maybe a 5-year review of how well we've done on this. I realise you've had a year of this and you've lived and breathed this, and I've been in several fora where it's obvious that it's taken over your life, but it would be really good in 5 years' time to come back and ask ourselves, Did we send that message really clearly to the private sector? Did we perhaps make some of the grants and levers that we can pull conditional upon doing this really, really well? And are we serious about it? Are we serious about it? So that would be my observation on how we bring the private sector to the table. And I think there are ways and means of doing that.
I want to pick up on the same theme briefly. I'm going to do something I didn't want to do, but I'm going to mention what was in our recent Growth Commission report, because there are sort of two sets of issues here. There's one's about what government does or does not do to encourage private business to behave in particular ways. And I think on some of the relevant issues, particularly making self-employment, effectively we're now in a situation in the UK where self-employment is relatively well-treated to being employed. And that has all sorts of implications for training and other things. And if you say, what would I hope the Chancellor might consider doing in the budget is to, and it's been even trailed that he might even be planning to do that, is to try and bring the treatment of self-employment into line with the treatment of employment. Because the employment relationship, in terms of giving strong incentives to train and to develop the potential of individuals, is pretty important. And we also need to, I think, bring into the tax code much more explicit incentives to encourage employers to train. The moment we give tax breaks for investing in physical assets, but we don't give similar tax breaks for investing in human assets. Sorry to put it in that rather blunt economistic way. But I think there's more than just what you do on incentives, and I think you will all be impressed by when you, in your business, in your local community, is the array of experience between businesses that are highly responsible, behave in the community in the kind of way we would all like them to, alongside other businesses that don't seem to behave in the same way. I'm a big believer in the importance of what I call industrial civil society, and it's pretty weak in the UK, comparatively speaking, to other countries, if you go to France or Germany. In Germany, I believe it's actually compulsory for every business to be a member of the Chamber of Commerce, and the Chamber of Commerce is a kind of civic organization that tries to encourage businesses to behave in particular ways. I think we need a review of, and I think it comes up in some of your report, of the whole idea of the civic culture in which business is located.
Well, I've stopped having expectations of budgets because that saves me being disappointed every year, really. The question of protectionism, what's happening within the global economy, apart from it sounds like another job for another RSA commission to look at that. If you just look at the United States and the crude headlines where the president says he wants to reduce imports into the United States, but he wants to give tax breaks for American companies for selling to other countries. Well, in order to do that, those other countries have got to buy, and that implies that deals have to be done. So I suspect the impact of protectionism is really being over-egged at the moment, and there will still be real imperatives around the world to maintain international trade, although clearly the terms of those trade are going to have to be renegotiated for a whole range of reasons. And that basically says to UK companies is that they need to be thinking about how they do make themselves as competitive as possible in order to be able to sell into what are likely to be, at least in the short term, somewhat more difficult markets. That protectionism question, international trade question, does actually link to the first one as well, though, that certainly evidence in Greater Manchester is that some of the problems we have with low pay and so on is the lack of ambition of our companies, and part of that lack of ambition is a lack of ambition to trade internationally. One of the things we have to do in order to address some of those zero-hour contracts and living wage issues is to raise the aspirations of a lot of our businesses about where they sit in the value chain. A lot of them at the moment are pilot high, sell it cheap. We need to change that business model so that they look to have more value in their business, and then to get more value in their business, they have to have more value in their employees.
Well, I think the just to say a bit about that globalisation thing. I mean, there are some heartening examples from the US as well, because if you actually look at how grassroots opinion has changed on globalisation and imports, even just in the last 10-20 years, yes. supporters of the Republican Party have shifted slightly more against free trade. But the party that traditionally had voters who were very much suspicious and much more instinctively anti-free trade than the Labour Party in the UK was the Democrats. And they now have sizable majorities of Democrat voters are actually in favour of open borders and globalisation. So it's not the case that you can't make the argument to different parts of the wage spectrum. People do understand the benefits to low-wage households and families of imports. And I think we are going to have an example of the benefits of openness and the implications potentially of not having openness in the what happens over the next few years in the UK. So I suspect some of that argument may already be made by some of those conversations that we're going to have endlessly over the next few years. On the budget and sort of broadly what you would hope would be picked up in this, you know, I'm encouraged by Tim's comments on this being a long burn, I think, or a slow burn. I mean, I think that's probably the case, but I do think there's a recognition that the data side of things has to be better, and the capturing the truly subjective aspects of growth is really hard. But if you tell them, actually, this isn't so much about that, it's just getting the local level data underneath the surface of the GVA, I think that would be more manageable for the ONS, which is quite hard-pressed at the moment, but I think that they could get to grips with that. And I think generally, as I said at the start, that the making an economy that works for everyone line, you know, is hanging over the government, and there will be pieces of this that they will want to do, I'm quite confident, as part of that agenda, even if it's not exactly the way that we're describing here. I think the training, if we hear talk of parity of esteem and moves on technical education, trying to make it more equivalent to academic routes from school to work tomorrow, that would be great. But I think it's an opportunity for all of us to then say, look, we've had this for a long time. It is recognising a problem, but you're the umpteenth Chancellor to recognise this problem. It is not just recognising the problem, it's about how you do it. And if you have these great national qualifications, fine, but how are you going to make the whole training skills set up work for individual places will be the next agenda that they need to take up.
Fantastic, thank you. So we're going to open up to questions. That gentleman on the end.
My name is David Cotton. I think we have to look at the whole world, not just at our economy. We have to get rid of our obsession with economic growth. We in this country actually have quite enough if we divided it more equally. And, of course, there are some very poor parts of the world. They should be enabled, encouraged to catch up with our economic level. But if we go on with growth, if we grow at 1%, for the next 100 years, and the rest of the world catches up with us, then by then the world economy will be 20 or 30 times what it is today, and there are just not enough natural resources to sustain such an economy.
Ben Hughes. Welcome very much the underlying principle of bringing together social and economic policy, and whilst it was good to hear you refer to the business community. What none of you referred to, except fleetingly Tim, was the role of the not-for-profit, voluntary, third sector, call it what you will. We have about 175,000 charities who, it would seem, if mobilised in an appropriate way, play an absolutely fundamental role in community economic development. And a very quick follow-on point, particularly to Irene, the whole place model and the principle of co-production, absolutely right. But it sounds very similar to me to the pilot around Total Place that we saw some 8 years ago that, as far as I could see, failed primarily because of the way the public sector works in siloed budgets. How do you think we can overcome that challenge?
Good afternoon. My name is Varo Yamato, and my question is really on the global goals for sustainable development, which the UK is a key contributor to, and to which extent you see this agenda being linked to the what we call as well the sustainable development goals.
So, question, is it just about, or should we think more about redistribution in the UK and globally? And there's sort of a technical convergence idea that I might pass over to Tim. There's the role of the voluntary sector and non-profits, which are very much mentioned in the report, but I'll allow others to elaborate on that. Is this total place Mark II, and do we need to think about how the lessons we learnt from that? And then finally, how does this fit into the sustainability agenda and the UN Millennium Goals and subsequent goals around that? So, starting with Stephanie, maybe.
I think there are lots of mentions of NGOs, and we were just going through so quickly, but when we talk about entrepreneurial whole place leadership, that's very much involving, and if I didn't say it by name, I definitely meant to be alluding to when I talked about having more people around the table and involving people in the design of policies, and then also making sure, to Tim's point, that you've designed the way you have designed a policy is not going to inadvertently exclude local players. I think Nottingham has had particularly good success on that, and making sure that their procurement processes were actively involving the local sourcing of things and local firms, social enterprise. So I think we are very much, that is part of the whole system, and I apologise if there wasn't a big element of that. I think I'll lead others to talk about the previous history of various phrases. Of course, you know, whole place and total system. I don't know how you could possibly see comparison between the two. You know, I have a sense that if something was a good idea 8 years ago, maybe it's now a good idea whose time has come. So it's not necessarily a reason not to do it. The very big picture on growth, you know, obviously there's a whole sustainability agenda, which we touch on, but it wasn't the fundamental focus of this report. I would say, at the risk of not pleasing the questioner, the sort of global welfare maximising position, perspective that many policymakers have had over the last few years, kind of reflexively, whether they followed through on it or not, is one of the things I think that people have reacted to in the last few years in the UK. The sense that is speaking to that sort of stateless concept that we only think about the world and not necessarily about more national needs. So while I totally sympathise with what you're saying, I think it's also not necessarily the time to be making those kind of arguments. Although, of course, as part of inclusive growth, there might well be a redistributive piece of that. We weren't necessarily talking about maximising growth. We're talking about focusing on the right kind of growth. So we're sort of leaving open your question.
Tim, can I come to you about this notion of global convergence and whether or not we need to be thinking, and also how that plays in against Stephanie's point that she's just making?
Well, it opens up a wide range of issues. I took as the remit for your commission that you were focusing primarily on sustainable and inclusive growth in the UK. But, of course, I think the question is quite right to say there's a wider global picture. And, of course, one of the paradoxes of Chinese economic development is that the ability to attract low-wage and low-skilled jobs from this country and from the US has caused many of the tensions in certain parts of the economy that your report is responding to. So there is always a paradoxical element to that, and one could, of course, that's never a case against not embracing poverty reduction around the world, but there's a complex interaction between global phenomena. But equally, and this comes to the question about the sustainable development goals, there are many countries in the world that are going backwards. And I confess to being a serial commissioner. Next Thursday, we are launching the LSE Fragile States Commission, which David Cameron has agreed to chair. We are looking precisely at issues of long-run sustainable growth from a global point of view, particularly focusing on countries which are particularly difficult to operate in. Let me make one more comment, though, about the growth obsession. I think it's important to differentiate growth and living standards. Now, too often those two are put together, but I can think of all sorts of areas where we need innovation in order to allow living standards to rise. The obvious area is innovations in health. We are on the brink, I hope, of a digital health revolution where we will all be, in 10 years' time, carrying something in us which is constantly monitoring our bodily
functions, I suppose, from the point of view of trying to detect potential health problems that might arise. There may even be cases where ambulances actually show up before we even know we're sick. These kinds of long-run changes and dynamics are important to embrace in an economy. That's what really raises living standards. And we'll never be able to measure them narrowly by economic growth. And I don't think anyone except the most boneheaded economists really believe that what we ultimately care about is the number of times we get to go down to McDonald's or the width of our widescreen TV. There are much deeper issues of what generate living standards. And I think that's what this report has been careful to highlight.
Yeah, if I pick up the pushback about the third sector, you're absolutely right to raise it. And if I also pick up Total Place on the basis that at the time when Michael Bichard was chairing that piece of work, I had the privilege of being on the panel and going to see that Total Place concept working in loads of innovative places across the UK. I really do think on some of the intractable issues that we have around inclusive growth, pulling back together that whole system. At the time, I remember around the table were directors general from health, DWP, DCLG, DCMS, alongside some chief executives in places around the UK who were doing this really well alongside the third sector. The third sector was represented by a CEVO, and Victor Abadouali at the time was involved. So they're very much embedded as part of looking at this as an issue. And this could be a reason why a refresh of that would be appropriate now. I do think, in general, post-Brexit, that the solution, I touched upon places working together that have similarities such as Coventry and Sunderland. We are a tiny, tiny nation, and if we could just get that concept of Total Place working again around thematic areas with social inclusion at its heart, I really do think it could have come of its time. It was 8-9 years ago when we first started talking about it. But if ever we could crack that one, I think we would have cracked social inclusion by now too.
Richard? Well, if I take two of the questions that were asked. First of all, on dividing it more equally. Well, actually, as a Labour politician, I'm fundamentally in favour of more equal distribution. I also think we need a bit more to distribute as well. So I agree with half of the question, but not the other half. In terms of the comments made about Total Place, if you look at page 21 of the Commission's report, there is a table that compares public expenditure in Greater Manchester 2008-09 with 2013-14. The 2008-09 figures come from Total Place. So Total Place is far from dead. It is now being brought forward as part of the Inclusive Growth Commission's report. And it's not dead for a range of reasons. Is that basically Total Place disappeared because Labour lost a general election. However, the ideas behind it didn't disappear. The coalition government basically adopted it, but in the way that changes of government do. They just gave it a new name, and the name they gave it was Whole Place. And effectively, the work that was done under the Whole Place community budget pilots is what really has spawned a lot of the understanding about how we ought to now have public service expenditure based around people, the places that they live and their communities and their families, rather than in departmental silos. So Total Place hasn't disappeared. To a certain extent, it's now become an almost normal part of the dialogue about how we ought to deliver public services.
Great, and where better to go next but to Liam, one of the ministers of that Labour government. Liam.
Thank you very much. I'm Liam Byrne. I'm chair of the all-party parliamentary group on inclusive growth. So I just want to start by saying a huge congratulations to Stephanie and the team for producing what's a really meaty report. It's exactly the kind of stuff that policymakers down the road need right now. I particularly welcome the emphasis on the dire state of regional productivity gaps. And I think it's really important that you've zeroed in on this. And obviously, two of the big contributory factors are the challenges in mobilising savings and mobilising skills. And as one of the architects of Total Place, one of the things we were pushing for in 2008, 2009 was devolution of control over skills spending. Now, there's $2.3 billion scored for the apprenticeship levy in this year and next. And so I just wonder if people could say a word about the potential to seek devolved control over much bigger chunks of the skills budget and the apprenticeship levy. And then if I can just tempt you into saying something about mobilisation of savings and the potential for regional banking too, that'd be great. Thanks.
Wonderful. In the spirit of inclusivity, I would like another woman to offer a question for me. Anyone there? Great, that lady there, and then we'll have to wrap up, I'm afraid.
Hi, my name is Siri. I'm a local economic development student at LSE, so I'm very happy about the place-based focus of this report. I was just wondering if the Commission had looked at more of the fundamental issues, such as the overall educational system in the UK and also the free and continuous access to a public health system.
Okay, some big questions posed by the last round there. So looking at devolution of skills, apprenticeship levy and regional banking, and the future of education and health, full stop. So maybe if we could start from Irene and work through.
If I could do the last one first in terms of education and health, doing what we've always done in the future just will not work. I think to go back to Tim's point about this issue of innovation, I think the creation of new models, which I suppose speak to this subject, but also speak to the wider issue of the fiscal situation and the austerity that we find ourselves in, mean that we need to do things radically different. I would use an example from Sunderland, because we're just about to do that, in terms of putting out in a totally owned company 100% of the interaction from birth of a child all the way through to the age 18 into an arm's length children's company, with innovation at the heart of how we radically restructure the way that we do that. I think that put it, one of the driving, I suppose, one of the main drivers for doing this is to address some of the inequalities that we have in Sunderland currently, and on the basis that what's worked for all of these years hasn't really succeeded. And I would think that there'd be probably many places across the country doing that again. Just to speak to Liam's point about the apprenticeship levy, I personally think that will be transformational. I do think it would be a tragic loss if any unspent levy remained at a national level rather than regional level, but I don't think I can really add any more than that.
Thank you, Tim.
Just say briefly on skills, because I agree with the subtext of the question that greater devolution but also greater integration between business with schools, FE colleges and universities is part of the skills framework we need, and there has been progress made, but there's a lot more to be done. But I am in favour of greater devolution in that sense. But we still, though, face a very big challenge. It's not about where you create skills, it's also retaining skills. And as someone who comes from a family that's part of the northern diaspora, I can tell you that the first thing that many people do when they get educated is to leave the area and come and live in London, as many of my family and extended family have done. So it's not just about where you create the skills. You've got to be able to retain them when you've created them. And if you look at the UK, insofar as we have good data, and it's quite limited, there has been an enormous exodus of skilled people from the poorer parts of the UK to the richer parts of the UK, and that's what's been driving inequality. So just creating more skills will not overcome the reason why people are leaving some of the poorer areas where the job opportunities are limited. So we need to put it together with all the other raft of policies to make those regional economies work better.
And paradoxically, even though there's that mass exodus into London, that doesn't necessarily negate the mass inequality that the capital also faces. But Richard?
I'm just going to deal with the skills and education question, and thank Liam actually signed the first devolution deal with Greater Manchester back in 2009, and that never got implemented because Labour lost a general election as well, but we didn't give up at that point. We kept going and signed another one 5 years later. which includes an element of skills devolution. The adult skills will be devolved to Greater Manchester from 2018, but that means that we will have an element of control over 17% of the skills budget. It's nowhere near enough, really. But as well as control influence over skills budgeting, we also need far greater influence over what is taught within our schools as well, and what's getting our young people ready for what happens afterwards. And I think this really is something that falls into the area that Stephanie's described as co-commissioning. I don't want to go back to a sort of age where there was a myth that we controlled our schools. I was the chair of an education committee in the 1980s. As far as I can see, we had no control over our schools whatsoever. It is about influencing the curriculum, what is in offer there, and making sure it's relevant to our young people when they leave school. So I think if I was to be asked what is the single biggest hole in Greater Manchester's devolution package, it is education and skills. And that's something I think we will keep working on until we fill that hole. Again, it's a difficult area here that, going back to the Manchester Independent Economic Review, one of the other things they recommended is we need to do more in terms of recruiting and retaining talent, and particularly highly skilled talent, which we've been quite successful in. And I saw being criticised in a report written by actually a couple of Manchester-based economists for being successful of creating the circumstances that recruits and retains talented people. I think we'll keep doing it, though, because it is absolutely crucial to our long-term future.
You know, I think I agree on the training thing clearly, and I think the good news is that the Treasury, which still has some influence over things, maybe not quite as much as in previous days, but previous years, does recognise that they have not got this right, which is always a good start. And they are also, I think, quite open to the idea of a place-based approach to it. I think this is where Tim's very good point, though, comes in. What the whole place is actually quite difficult, particularly when it comes to training. Because one of the things we made, the point that was made in the City Growth Commission and that we make, is that, you know, where the jobs happen or the jobs are done during the day, where the training happens is not necessarily where the, you know, the full value is generated. And it may certainly not be where the person lives who's doing those jobs or doing that training. So trying to get the sort of let boundaries right, trying to get the right unit which is going to capture some of those features, I think is really tough. You know, I do think we should emphasise as well, which comes through in some of the questions, you know, that Sir Richard said, which is that the local government has to step up to the plate a bit on this. And it struck me a lot in talking to people around the country that, you know, ownership, we talk about local ownership, you know, you have to feel it, but the people who are doing the policy actually have to earn it as well. And I think there is going to be a test of that with the mayor elections and others, and I know that many people recognise that. On the finance point that Liam mentioned, we do discuss the potential for regional banking institutions. If you sense a certain sort of tentative nature for some of those proposals relative to others, I think it was because I was a little wary of creating local institutions before I really was confident that they were going to solve a problem, because I wanted to think about what the problem was. I think the biggest challenge and the hole that we've had in our UK financial system since at least the 1880s, when the first report on the subject came out, is not serving the full country and providing finance for small businesses elsewhere. Now, it could be that the solution to that is local or regional financial institutions, but I need a bit more convincing, especially when I know that the carnage that some local financial institutions have wrought in various financial crises all over the world over the last 50, 100 years. But I do think trying to find nationally ways for more of our savings to be channeled into things that aren't houses would always be a good thing to try and do. Look, finally, which also relates to something that Liam said, I want to make sure that everyone realises that this report really is about addressing making inclusive growth an economic issue as well as a political and a social issue. It's you know, we've learnt again and again across the country that jobs are no longer the greatest way to reduce poverty, raise living standards. That's different. That's not been the case in British history before, that we've had the majority of people living in poverty are in work, or households have in poverty have someone who's in work. That is because we have too many people trapped in these low-wage, low-productivity traps. Our low productivity is the country's biggest economic problem, as well as everything else. And all of the things we have in the report, to some extent, are about trying to tackle that problem. And the devolution piece is because we think that it's pretty hard to do that in any way, but to do it just in the top-down way is really going to be sort of stupid and counterproductive. So just to sort of bring it home, I am still... The Economist is still... the one that's influencing this commission, as well as the one who's focused on a broader sense of growth. I really think this is an economic agenda now, not just a political one.
Fantastic. And we've long since run out of time. Thank you for indulging us this afternoon. I'd like to say thank you to you all. I can see many familiar faces in the audience who have contributed to the work of the Commission. So thank you for coming today and for your contributions over the last 12 months. Thank you to our funders. Thank you to Stephanie and the Commissioners. It's been a real pleasure. And thank you to my team, Atif, Kenny, David, and others who have made it all possible. So a huge thank you again. And look forward to making this not just a report, but an agenda that will continue, and we will reap the benefits over the next few months and beyond. So thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.